Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are always online at npr.org. It just occurred to me, we've been talking an awful lot, and I love the sound of your voice. I know,
oh, yeah.
But I really love yours. But
yeah, you have I love yours, Rachel. It's a good voice that I
but
have.
But I think we need other voices involved in this
More
show.
Voices.
I think we need other people involved in the show. I think I would like to hear from the BPP producers, our people mm-hmm. who've been scouring the internet for the most emailed, most read, mostest stories on the internet. Let's do the most.
Oh, I thought you would just ask them about what they think of my voice.
No.
Was it the siren song that lured them to the Bryant Park
it
Project?
Must have been.
You guys were
yeah.
all here before me. What am
if
I
If that were the
about?
Case, you would have been here a long time ago, don't you think, Mike?
You would have crashed on the rocky shoals of the yeah. Bryant Park.
Ian,
yes.
You get us on topic, please.
Yes, I'm happy to write this ship. You know, usually we do most emailed, most popular. My most this morning is just the most. It's the most everything.
It's the most everything?
It's the most interneted. It's the most dug on dig. But yeah, you may remember that, you know, after Barack Obama wrapped up the nomination, before he took the stage for his speech in St. Paul, he and Michelle, his wife, shared a very special moment. They fist bumped. They, you know, knocked fists. And the internet just went crazy for it yesterday.
I hate when the internet goes crazy, when you got to talk the internet down from a ledge.
By the morning, it had been added to Wikipedia's list of great fist bumps in popular culture.
I didn't know there was such a list.
Yeah, you know, there aren't many, but this is one of them. You know, it came under the headings, the most high-profile pound, that's another word for it, of all time, the best fist bump in history. New York Daily News yesterday called it the fist bump of hope, and that and said that it showed they were silly in love. It was called a great moment in American history. BuzzFeed said,
"Let's not get carried away."
You know, you just won the Democrats' nomination for president. Time to punch it in. People, you know, just really saw it as a sign of love.
Do you think they were holding on to that until they know they had it locked up? Like it could have become a Jeffrey Wright-esque source of controversy.
No, it seemed like very, very spontaneous. I think you know, it even like. By the time Brian Williams got to talk to Obama, listen to this.
Your wife came up on stage with you last night, and in an otherwise private moment, attempted to give her husband a fist pound. It was an inside move shared in front of 17,500 people in the arena and millions watching at home. It's the most talked about fist pound on the internet today.
Indeed it was.
I would have loved to be in the room when the production assistant had to explain to Brian Williams what a fist pound was.
No.
When Brian Williams had a manila envelope at this moment, and he opened it up and showed it to Barack Obama, and it had a picture of the fist bump in there, like, you know, visual aid for the NBC viewers that may not have known. So I looked around and to see if, you know, this is definitely the first one in presidential politics.
Well, actually, Albin Barkley, I thought, fist bumped FDR.
Yes, that's true. That's true. It went by a different name back then. apparently, in 2001, when the CEOs of Hewlett-Packard and Compaq announced their
that's
merger...
Great.
They bumped fists.
Oh, man.
So,
Carly
Fiorina. She was one of them.
Exactly.
And some people say she might be McCain's vice president.
Wow. Oh, weird.
It's all tying up.
Coincidence?
I don't think so.
That would that incent the campaign to ask?
Yeah. I knew we were going with the incent word again.
Oh man.
That's
was
great
a good
stuff.
One.
I love that story.
Most,
that is the most.
Yeah.
I agree. That's the most everything.
It's the most.
Give it a shot, though, Dan. You're next.
I'll see what I can do. Most emailed from Yahoo News. Japanese patient's tumor turns out to be a 25-year-old towel.
Wow.
And that's the end of the story. Goodbye. Thank you.
I understood the verb in that sentence.
When you first read this, I thought it was like, you know, in Seinfeld when that thing gets caught in the body.
The junior mint?
No, the junior mint. Was a towel caught in someone's body?
Yes, basically, yes. The guy had ulcer surgery 25 years ago. They dropped a towel inside him by accident, and it's been there ever since.
See, I was picturing, like, beach towel, like a giant towel.
Best quote of the article... The towel was greenish-blue, although we are not sure about its original color.
Actually, I think that does happen a lot.
It's the most
Maybe
grossest.
Not for 25 years, but yeah, people leave things behind.
But he did still have surgery. His spleen removed, which is the original reason, and he has no plans to sue. They're going to compensate him somehow, but turns out he's going to be fine.
Great. A new towel.
Yeah. Actually, they're just
going to get a full set of linens.
They're just going to pay for the dry cleaning, I think.
I just thought that it was wrong that the doctor monogrammed it beforehand.
Oh, well,
Trish.
All right, I have a Google Trends mystery. I'm really annoyed because I don't have the answer to this. I'll cop to that right away. I checked the Google Trends this morning to see what people have been searching in the last 24 hours, and up there on the list was Fisher Space Pen, which has now dropped down to number 14, but it's still up there. Searches for Fisher Space Pen spiked at about 5 p.m. Pacific, so about 8 p.m. Eastern. I have been tracking this thing down. I cannot figure out why people would have been searching for it. Rachel gave me a clue at the beginning of the first hour when I thought, when you were talking about The Price is Right being in primetime, and I thought, ooh, maybe the Fisher Space Pen was on The Price is Right, but you didn't watch the whole show.
Yeah, I only watched the first 15 minutes.
So I don't know. So if anybody out there knows, I had Laura Silver working on it. She couldn't find anything.
Okay, BPP listeners.
She could confirm UN aid support, but she couldn't figure out the exactly. Space Pen. I like
Fisher Space Pen, why? Don't know.
Could it have been the pen they used to write out of order on the toilet at the International Space Station? Is that
worth tracking down? Don't know.
Do you know anything about Paul C. Fisher? That's a whole nother segment. This guy was great. He ran for president a couple times, libertarian tax activist, invented the space pen. We could do worse than him. Anyway.
I know these things.
Yeah.
Mark Garrison, quickly, you're going to wrap it up.
I do. I have a most emailed on Yahoo News. The headline is Missing Cape Cod Lighthouse Located in California. apparently ships have been crashing into the coast in Cape Cod for a long time. But basically, the historians actually thought it had just been destroyed in 1925, that it was gone. But I have to stop here because journalistic courtesy requires that we explain where we found this survey. And this was reported in this month's edition of Lighthouse Digest. Mm-hmm. They broke this
Good
news.
Man.
I read this often. I actually have it up right now. And Keeper's Corner, that's Corner with a K. Is
of course it is.
A column I look at each month. But basically, they're not sure how it got there.
Is their slogan like shining a light on the news since 1802?
I don't know. I got to look a little closer like that. Yeah. They do have Returned to Cape Fear. So
okay,
I don't know
can
if, like,
we
Robert
figure
Mitchum
out where
or,
the lighthouse
anyway, okay,
went? We got
it showed up. Showed up in California, and they're not sure how it got there. They think they just disassembled it and took it on a train and got it out there. Actually, interestingly, if you're in Montara, California, it's now a hostel, so you
cool.
can stay there.
All right. The lighthouse lives on. Matt Martinez, you're going to wrap it up.
I am. One of the most emailed at NPR. Feds aim to dismantle LA's 18th Street gang. It's by NPR correspondent Mandalit Del Barco. And it's part of NPR's four-part series on gangs. Just great series that we've been doing over the past couple of days. And it looks at this particular piece looks at how law enforcement has targeted the 18th Street gang, which is considered the largest in Los Angeles. So here's Mandalit with a report.
For more than a decade, the FBI has been trying to take down the 18th Street gang, but generations of gang leaders have made it difficult. 18th Street has as many as 30,000 members spread across Los Angeles and even into Central America, but it's actually a collection of small groups or cliques, like the notorious Columbia Lil Psychos.
They're known for murders, robberies, kidnappings. They make a lot of money selling dope.
LAPD gang officer Magdaleno Gomez sits in the windowless Rampart Detective Bureau he shares with FBI agents. He says the Columbia Lil Psychos have ruled the streets of LA's Westlake District since the 1960s. Gomez says the clique offers protection from rival gangs in exchange for taxes or rent, essentially a cut of the profits from illegal street sales.
Whether it be narcotics, fake green cards or fake passports, fake driver's licenses, they tax the illegal vendors, the people that sell food, anything counterfeit. Anything illegal that goes on in the street, they take a cut from that.
Gomez's partner, Edgar Hernandez, says dealers and vendors understand the consequences of refusing to pay taxes to the clique.
Individuals that didn't want to pay for selling illegally on the streets have got shot, stabbed, and have even been murdered.
When one vendor stood up to the gang in September, he was shot, and a 23-day-old baby was killed. Here's how TV news station KCAL reported it.
Three gang members apparently targeting 38-year-old Francisco Clemente, who was selling DVDs in the neighborhood, shot and critically wounded Clemente, but a stray bullet hit baby Luis.
Six members of the Columbia Lil Psychos will soon stand trial for the baby's murder. A month after the killing, the FBI arrested the leader of that clique, the so-called Shock Caller. He was busted on federal charges for distributing crack cocaine, along with his wife and 17 alleged associates and drug dealers. His name is Sergio Pantoja, but he's known on the streets as Tricky. Officer Hernandez says Tricky operated a tattoo parlor that was actually a front for an elaborate drug dealing and extortion racket.
At his tattoo shop, he had the emblem of the Mexican flag, the eagle, eating the snake, kind of like some carnales might have. And I would always tell them, why do you have that? You're from El Salvador.
Hernandez says Turkey's tattooed back, chest, and arms are also filled with Aztec and Mexican symbols, possibly to show allegiance to the Mexican Mafia, a huge Latino prison gang made up of leaders from many street gangs. Turkey is just the latest alleged shot caller in a tangled hierarchy running from the streets to the prisons.
Who's ultimately at the top of that chain?
Puppet. He's the brother. He's the man. He's the M.A.
He's not really the puppet. He's the puppet master.
Pulling all the strings from federal prison.
Francisco Puppet Martinez is allegedly a member of the Mexican Mafia, a target of an FBI takedown in 2003. Bruce Reardon handled the case as a federal prosecutor.
Puppet Martinez was incarcerated at that time in federal prison on immigration charges. However, the evidence showed that Mr. Martinez was still running the Columbia Little Psychos from prison, and he was doing so through the auspices of his wife, Janie Garcia, who was also known as La Senora, the lady boss of the gang, and an individual by the name of Juan Romero, who was also known as Termite.
You know how my house is? The house has termites?
Over years of investigations, the FBI wiretapped recorded conversations between Martinez and his associates, like this one, in which they discussed their theory that Termite was snitching to the authorities.
Is the house has termites?
Yeah.
You know, and they had fumigated it. But I don't know. I think the termites are back.
In this recording, Martinez supposedly orders his associate Termite to be fumigated. Prosecutor Reardon says that's code for having him killed. The FBI also intercepted letters written by Puppet from prison giving the green light for murdering Termite in L.A. Reardon says the orders were used as evidence to build up what became a federal racketeering case against Martinez and 26 others.
This sequence of events shows the incredible organization of this enterprise. I don't think that you'll see a much more organized or structured enterprise anywhere, including on HBO with The Sopranos. This organization was a business. When the business was threatened by either the FBI or by a disloyal employee, the head of the business, the Mexican Mafia, took steps to eliminate the threat. In this case, Romero.
The attempt to murder Romero was unsuccessful, but the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office were able to convict Martinez with a life sentence plus 60 years. Reardon says until then, local police and prosecutors were only able to arrest lower-level gang members for individual crimes, but getting victims to testify against them was a problem. They're also frightened of retaliation. Reardon says using federal informants and wiretaps now make it possible to lock up the higher-up leaders and put them away in federal prison.
In cases that are no different in scope and significance from the cases that many people are familiar with that have taken down the five families of New York.
Retired L.A. Sheriff Deputy Richard Valdemar was on the FBI task force to take down the 18th Street Gang in the 1990s. He argues that locking up gang leaders has only strengthened the Mexican Mafia, whose members find ways to send out orders to the street gangs from behind bars.
The system itself tries to isolate them and take away their privileges, but the underground covert system feeds them and makes them powerful. Some of these guys are brilliant, too. We can't think of gang members as being dumb kids who failed in school and who just took up a thug life. No, these guys that reached the top in the prison gang food chain, these guys are brilliant, and they could run corporate organizations here if they had a mind to do that.
Gang researcher Alex Alonso, who runs the website streetgangs.com, says with each takedown, new, sometimes more violent shot callers rise up in the ranks.
Within, you know, a short time, there's going to be new guys from the 18th Street to replace the old guys that were removed, and it's just going to create this probably turnover. It's only a matter of sometimes hours to minutes.
Even so, federal and local authorities believe they put a dent in the 18th Street Gang's criminal enterprise, at least for now.
That was NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reporting. You can find a link to that and all the stories you heard on today's Most by going to our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.